Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey, and your moderator this morning. Today is Sunday, July 14, 2024. The share ID numbers for Friday, July 12th are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 21,567. That's 21567. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 21,569. That's 21569. This morning, A Vision for You presents After Surrender, the Next Frontier. In step one, we conceded powerlessness, the realization that we are doomed. Lack of power is our dilemma. We cannot solve the problem of compulsive overeating by ourselves. In step two, we learn that our higher power, which is deep down within us, was blocked off from us because of calamities, because of pomp, because of worship of other things. In step three, we made a decision to place our will and our lives into the care of our higher power to proceed with our work of the remaining steps. The fourth step brings us to a specific course of action that strengthens the decision we made in the third step and helps us carry it out. According to the Big Book, unless we make a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us, our decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God can have little permanent effect. The self-searching of the fourth step is the means by which we begin to bring new vision and light upon the dark and negative side of our natures. Since this power is deep down inside of us, what is preventing us from having an effective relationship with it? Our goal in this next frontier is to root out the causes of our living problems in order to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us from the sunlight of God's Spirit. Joining us today is Janet B., a recovered compulsive overeater from North Carolina. Janet is a loyal servant of Overeaters Anonymous, intensively working with other compulsive overeaters and dedicated to carrying the message of recovery. And it's with great appreciation and always a delight to welcome Janet B. to the line. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Leah. Good morning, everyone. This is Janet B., recovered compulsive eater in North Carolina. So I am going to pick up on the bottom of page 63 of the Big Book right after we've taken our third step. And as Leah just so beautifully put it, we really can't take step four in a vacuum. If we do, we're just doing self-therapy. So what do we have to do before? We have to see that we're powerless, right? That in spite of my best efforts, I can't do anything. I can't stop binging. In step two, I come to believe that a power greater than myself, God, can restore me to sanity. What if I don't believe in God? Here's my 30-second answer. On page 45 of our book, it tells us that the main object of our Big Book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. If this power, God, who like created the universe, flung the stars in the sky, is going to take time out of everything going on in this world, right? War, poverty, assassination attempts, to help me with my food problem, this must be a God who cares about me. And that's a God who I can decide to turn my entire will and life over to, not just my food plan, but everything, my will, my life, how I parent, how I show up at work, how I deal with my husband, what I do with my time. I surrender it all to God. And now sometimes people say, well, I surrendered everything to God. I've given my life to God. How come I can't stop binging? But our program makes really clear, right, over and over, faith without works is dead. And so the work that's given to us now is to clear away the wreckage of our past. So we're going to pick up very bottom of page 63. It says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. Look at those words, launched. Like, makes me think of a rocket. Launched, hard work, vigorous action, hard work. It says, a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted, though our decision, meaning our decision to turn our will and lives over to God, was vital, vital, life-giving, and crucial. It could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Okay, there is so much in that one little sentence. It says, our recovery can be permanent. Guys, we can recover, get abstinent, and never binge again. In fact, that's supposed to be the norm, permanent recovery. But what do we have to do to get it, right? Surrender to God, and then a strenuous effort, meaning a lot of work, to face and be rid of the things in me that have been blocking me from God. And then it says our liquor, or for us, our food, was but a symptom. You know, so often people say, well, the food blocks me from God. You know, that's not what our big book says. Our big book says the things in ourselves, so our character defects, our fears, and our resentments are what block us from God. The liquor or the food is a symptom of being blocked from God, right? So it goes like this. I get spiritually blocked from God by my character defects, my resentments, and my fears. Those spiritually block me. So if I'm blocked, that means I'm not getting God's protection. I have blocked it myself with my self-will, character defects, fear, and resentment. And so I am not safe and protected. And as a result, the food can come in and I have nothing to say about it. Okay, so I think that's really important. So it's not that the food blocks us. If I'm in the food, it's a symptom that I'm already spiritually blocked. So this is telling me I've got to clear that up, clear up what blocks me. And so it says, this is step four. Just like a business has to take a regular inventory, so do we. And what's the point? To just find the damaged or unsaleable goods. Now, sometimes people say, you know, well, I have to feel a certain way through it. I don't think that's what the book says. Some people get really emotional through it. Some people feel nothing through it. I think either way is fine. The whole point is to look and see what are the damaged and unsaleable parts of my character. And it says, if the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values, meaning I can't think that I'm better than I am. And just as an aside for having gone through the steps and when we do our nightly reviews, that's really a mini 4 through 9 on a daily basis. I'm to look at, you know, my resentments and my fears, and not just list them, but really analyze them the same way that I did when I was doing my fourth step. And we cannot fool ourselves about values. I have to say that I am pretty ruthless on myself when I do my nightly review. I have confessed prejudice. I have confessed things about, gosh, deep down in my heart, I wish that person wasn't even alive. Of course, I confess it and I go to God and I say, please, I'm sorry, please remove this. But I don't hide it and pretend that, you know, I'm all sunshine and roses and little kittens, because I am not. So the text says we did exactly the same thing with our lives as a businessman does with his business. It says we took stock honestly. So the numero uno thing we do, we search out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. So again, if you talk to 10 different people, you will probably hear 10 different ways of doing the fourth step, all of which comport with the big book. So I'm not here to convince anyone that this is the way. I'm just here to suggest this is a way and that might be helpful. So first, to search out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. So I give my sponsees a defect list. And I've listed, you know, my defects, which there are a great number of them, you know, and the common defects. And I ask them, look up the definition, just a quick, you know, one sentence definition, one word opposite, and then an example of how you are in the defect. And this is part of the just getting out all the secrets that we have to get out. So some of the defects that are on my list, you know, other than the obvious ones like selfish, self-centered, entitlement, that is a big one. Thinking that I am entitled to anything, that God or other people owe me anything. Another one on there, control, which is really playing God, right? Wanting to, people to do what I want them to, wanting God to do what I want him to. And idolatry. The definition I use for that is putting a person, place, or thing ahead of God. And the opposite of that would be really keeping God number one. So I ask for a list of defects. And then after that, our book continues on, page 64. It says resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics, more compulsive eaters than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. And then it tells us we've been mentally, physically ill, but we've been spiritually sick. And guys, look at the order. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So that means I can't expect to have long-term physical abstinence or mental clarity if I am not dealing with the spiritual malady, my defects of character, my resentment, my fears, and the things that have caused me to harm others. And it tells me once I do that, I straighten out mentally and physically. So then it gives us a very specific way of dealing with this. It says, okay, we set pen to paper, or nowadays sometimes we set fingers to computer, right? And we list our resentments. And we ask ourselves why we're angry. And it gives us a list. Self-esteem. So that means if someone says to me, Janet, you think you're so smart, but you're an idiot. And I feel like, oh, I'm really an idiot. And I resent that person. They've affected my self-esteem. My pocketbook, right? If someone threatens my job, so threatens my finances, it'll affect my pocketbook. My ambitions. Now, I don't believe this means my career ambitions. It can be my ambitions to have things go a certain way. So for instance, when my kids were little, and if my husband would take them to eat fast food and I would get angry, it would affect my ambitions. My ambitions to have my kids only be fed a certain way. Our personal relationships. That's if you went up to my best friend and said, Janet's an idiot, you shouldn't hang out with her anymore. And then my friend said, okay, you're right, I won't hang out with her anymore. You've affected my personal relationships. And sex relationships, if you flirt with my husband, that might affect my sex relationships. So we look and we see what's been affected. And they give us great examples, just, right, Bill Wilson's examples. Mr. Brown, why? He paid attention to my wife. What does it affect? My sex relations. So we go through all our resentments. And again, the way I tell my sponsees to do it is I say, first list these three columns. You resent, why, and what it affects. Because if you notice, our big book takes a pause here. These first three columns, and then it says, okay, nothing counted but fearlessness and honesty. And top of page 66, yes, sometimes we see this world and other people, we're often wrong, but we can't stop here. And they say sometimes it was remorse and we were sore at ourselves. So I would say remorse is one of three types of guilt that we can have. The first is like a vague sense of guilt. Like, yeah, I think I wasn't too nice. And yeah, or when people say, I wasn't the best friend I could have been. Well, that's vague. That's a lot different than saying, I gossiped about my best friend. right? So we can have a vague sense of guilt. That will just keep us in the food. True guilt is me saying, ugh, I did this really bad thing. I took $10 from my coworker's wallet. Okay, then I feel true guilt, and I should feel guilt. Remorse is when I've felt guilty, fixed it, but I still don't believe that God will forgive me. So let's say I took $10 from my coworker's wallet, which, by the way, I have not. It's an example. And I go back to her and say, you know, Susie, I took $10 from your wallet. I'm really sorry. Here's the $10 back. And I confess it to my sponsor, and I confess it to God and ask God to forgive me. It's over. It's done. If I keep having remorse, all that is self-centered self-pity, and then I'm of no use to anyone. Vague guilt, not of use to me or anyone, because what that really is it's me thinking that by feeling guilty enough, like self-penance, then eventually I will have been forgiven and, you know, atonement would have been made or something like that. But that's not what our program tells us to do. It says we have to just name it, what we have done. We have to be very specific, no vague guilt. But once we have dealt with it, talked to another person about it, gone to God for forgiveness, no remorse. It's over. It's done with. God forgives us. And if I'm sitting here believing, okay, I've told Susie, I took her money, I gave her money back, I told my sponsor, I've told God, I've asked God to forgive me, and I still am wallowing in remorse, then there's a problem with my relationship with God. That really means I think I'm smarter than God, because our book tells us, even at the end of this chapter, right, that if we're sorry for what we've done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will have been forgiven. Well, who am I to not forgive myself if God has forgiven me? So it may seem like a form of humility, like, oh, I feel so bad over what I've done, but I think it's really a form of pride. Guys, we are so lucky. We have a God who forgives. All we have to do is make things right, and then it is forgiven. So they go ahead and they tell us, okay, you've written your first three columns, and that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. And they give an equation for normal people, right? To the exact extent that we live in resentment, we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. Well, that makes sense, right? I live in resentment 100 hours. I've wasted 100 hours of my life. And they say, but, so for a compulsive eater, an alcoholic, it's even more deadly than just squandering the time. They say for the alcoholic, the compulsive eater, whose hope, and I say whose only hope, is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, resentment is grave, right? It puts us in our grave. It is fatal. That means it causes death. So they're telling us, first, my only hope is to maintain and grow my spiritual experience. Okay, so what is a spiritual experience? First of all, right, we have to know what that is. And on page 25, they tell us, we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences. It's a phenomena by which God changes our hearts and our lives, revolutionizes our whole attitude toward life, our fellows, and God's universe, whereby the central fact of our lives is the absolute certainty, right? We are positive that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is miraculous. And He, God, has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we couldn't do for ourselves. So that's my hope, to have that. But they say not just to have it, but to grow it. Well, how do you grow a spiritual experience? I think it's, how do you grow anything? How do you grow up a plant? You pull up the weeds and you take care of it. So we pull up the weeds. We pull up the weeds of resentment. And they tell us when we harbor such feelings of resentment, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. And then the insanity of alcohol or food returns to us and we drink or binge again. So we're all going to get resentment. We're human. But we cannot be a safe harbor for resentment, right? Think of a harbor. That's where ships go to dock when a storm is coming, and they're there and they're safe until the bad weather has gone. I can't be a harbor for resentment. I can't say, okay, I have this resentment. Just hang out here for a while. It's fine. I have to deal with it right away, because as long as I'm harboring it, I'm cutting myself off from God, and then I am in trouble. Why? Because God is this like big bad ogre, and if I don't do everything perfectly, he's out to get me. No. I think it's the opposite. I think we can go back to our middle school social studies where we learned about the kings, and he had, you know, the serfs who worked the land. And as long as the serfs work the land, the king keeps them safe and protected. The good king, right? So when the invading army comes, the king like sounds the trumpet or whatever and has the drawbridges to be pulled up so that everything on the king's land, everyone on the king's land is safe and protected, because this king loves his people. But let's say someone wanders off out of resentment toward the king, or self-will, or thinking, I know better, wanders off the king's land. Well, then when the invading army comes and I'm not on the king's land safe and protected, it's not because this king doesn't love me, it's because I've run away. They're saying by resentment, by harboring resentment, we are running away. We are blocking ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, from our king. And by the way, I personally believe that this God, our king, is not only loves us enough to protect us when we're there on his land doing what we're supposed to, but when we're not, sends out search and rescue missions to try to bring us home. Okay, so they continue and they say, if we're to live, we had to be free of anger, right? We have to find a way. And they say, we turn back to our list, because this is the key to the future. This is the key to living happily. And so it's, okay, we're going to look at it from a different angle. We begin to see other people, yeah, they may be wrong, may be real, may be fancied, but it can kill me, right? Because it cuts me off from the sunlight of God's spirit. It says, these have to be mastered, but how? Bottom of page 66. This was our course. I love it, right, guys? They give us specific instructions. We realize that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. I want to just say a word of caution here, because I think this word perhaps is the most underutilized word in this book. Perhaps spiritually sick. It is very easy for me to get on my high horse on a spiritual hilltop and say, oh, well, you know, Mother Teresa was spiritually sick because she didn't do things the exact way I wanted. Perhaps spiritually sick. And my sponsor has actually changed it to human, just like me. People have their good days and they have their bad days. Perhaps spiritually sick, or spiritually developing, just like me. So we don't like their symptoms, top of page 67, but they, like ourselves, were human. We're spiritually developing also. We ask God. So whenever it says we ask God, it means we pray. We ask God to help us show people tolerance, pity, and patience, that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Or I say that I would want granted to me on my bad days. So what do we ask God for? Tolerance. I think that's really for my tolerance to grow, my threshold to withstand pain or sorrow or remarks, it's raised, that I don't get offended so easily, right? We're supposed to outgrow hypersensitivity. In my big book, I've crossed out the word pity and written compassion, because someone said that the word pity, when it was used at the time of the big book, was a little different. Compassion. So I pray for compassion and patience. And remember, without prayer, I'm just doing self-therapy and it doesn't work. So we pray. And we pray, this is perhaps a sick man or a spiritually developing person or a human being just like me. How can I be helpful? God, save me from being angry, right? I need to be rescued from my own anger. And I pray, God, thy will be done. And I think it's important to look at people's situations. You know, when I was growing up, my dad worked a lot of hours and he yelled at us a lot. He really did. But I think back and I think when he grew up, his father didn't have a job, couldn't always hold a job, was an alcoholic who beat them. My dad worked. He didn't beat us. He just yelled. So in God's eyes, I think my father was a saint. Okay, so we look back at their person, at them. We try to get compassion. It says we avoid retaliation or argument. We don't get them back. We don't fight. Why? Because then we can't be helpful. And it's, that's our goal, to be helpful. But at the very least, the minimum, God shows us how to be kind and tolerant to them. So now we pick up our liturgy after praying. And what I do with my sponsees is I have them do the first three columns, and then I go over this with them, and I tell them to spend an hour in prayer. Not an hour per person on their list, an hour, asking God to soften their heart, asking God to, you know, praying for God to save them from their anger, asking God to show them tolerance, compassion, and patience, an hour to soften our hearts. Only then do we pick up our list again. And we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done and look for our own mistakes. So here's how, again, I do it. And again, I am not saying this is the only way or the best way. I'm just offering up as a way to do it. I have two more columns. Column four is where, what is my part? And, you know, some people do it where, you know, where have I, for each resentment, where have I been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, frightened? I don't do that because, one, I think it's very awkward. People have called me up and said, I can't figure out the difference between selfish and self-seeking. And sometimes I'm not dishonest in my resentments, right? If I say, you know, Susie took $10 from my wallet and I resent her, well, I'm not dishonest. She really took $10 out of my wallet, right? So I just say, let me look for my part. And that's why doing this defect list first is so helpful. So let me just give some examples of what my part would be. Sometimes my part might be not setting boundaries. So an example, let's say I have a sponsee who texts me all day long and I find I'm starting to get angry about it. I think, okay, what's my part? I haven't set a boundary. Now, I mean, someone might set a boundary of do not text me more than once a day. My boundary that I set with my sponsees is text me however much you want, but I am not going to feel obligated to answer every text you send to me. This way, I'm not resentful. They get to text how much they want. I have set a boundary. But let's say I was resentful at, you know, my sponsee Susie because she texts me all day long. It affects my ambition to not be disturbed during the day. That's my ambition. What would my part be? Not setting an appropriate boundary. What are my defects? So my last column is my defects. What defects have caused me to not set an appropriate boundary? Maybe it's fear. Fear then that Susie won't like me. Sometimes our part is not having hard conversations, right? We just like things are hard and we become peace fakers. We have a fake sense of peace. This is often in our closest relationships, maybe in our marriages, with our parents or with our kids. We don't have hard conversations. Or sometimes at work, right? So let's say I get angry that my boss sends me emails on Sunday because I don't want to work on Sunday. Well, my part would be, you know, so I resent my boss. He's sending me work to do on Sunday. What does it affect? My pocketbook, right? Because if my boss thinks I'm not doing a good job, he may fire me. My ambition to be left alone on Sunday. What's my part? Not having a hard conversation, not going to my boss and saying, you know, listen, happy to do work for you, but not on Sundays. I don't work on Sundays. Sometimes with, or let's say, I say, my husband keeps the air conditioning on so cold at night? What does it affect? My ambition to get a good night's sleep, my sex relations, because it gets me mad at my husband and I don't want to be near him. What's my part? Not having a hard conversation that I don't want the air conditioner kept on at night. Now, obviously, that's not a really hard conversation, but sometimes we have to have those hard conversations and we don't do it because we're peace fakers. A lot of times my part is something is none of my business. So here are some things that are none of my business. Who other people want to keep or not keep in their life? Other people's relationships with each other. So here's one that I had. I resented how my father treated my mother. This is what he did. He would be sitting down in the living room and there would be, let's say, a muffin on the table right in front of him. And my mom would be on the other side of my house and he would call, Gloria, could you come cut my muffin for me? And then my mother would run into the room and cut his muffin for him. Okay. Now, so I would resent how my father treated my mother. What's my part? You know, what does it affect? My ambition. I don't think my mother should be treated that way. What's my part? It's none of my business. What are my defects there? Obviously controlling, playing God. Now, let me tell you the rest of the story. My mom comes in, cuts his muffin or whatever it is that he wants to do that's 2 inches in front of him, and she runs across the house to do. She cuts up his muffin, and he gives her a big kiss and says, thank you, Gloria, I love you. And she gives him a big kiss back and says, oh, Sam, I love you too. And then they are as happy as can be, and for 50 years, this was their relationship, and they were so in love and so happy. Now, P.S., I got married, and one day my husband had a cold, and he's sitting in his chair, and I said, can I bring you a cup of tea? And he said, I have a cold, I'm not crippled. Right? Different people, different relationships. And of course, for that, I didn't get a resentment. I laughed because I thought, I so did not marry my father. Other things that are not my business. I used to get angry. When my kids were in high school, I would make them lunch and they would come home from school and I would empty their lunchbox and there would be the whole lunch there, not eaten. Either they didn't eat or they, I don't know, ate something. I have no idea. And then someone once said to me, you know, and so I said, I resent it. I make my kids lunch every day and they don't eat it. Well, what's my part? My job is to play the role God assigns me. If I believe God wants me to make lunch for my kids every day, then I do it. And what they do with it is none of my business. By the way, the way I solve that problem is I would ask my kids on the weekend, what do you guys want to make for lunch during the week? And I would buy those things to have in the house for them. And then I told them, you know, by now they were 16 or so, you can make your own lunch. And I'll tell you, most days, my son went to school without making lunch, without eating lunch. I don't know how he made it. And, you know, he didn't eat breakfast either. I have no idea how he made it through. But I'll tell you this, right now, my son is away doing his military training. He is fit. He is strong. He is healthy. Whether or not my kids eat their lunch is none of my business. Here's something else that was none of my business. Of course, like a great mother, I did not want my kids eating McDonald's or junk food. So if my husband took them out to eat junk food, I resent my husband. Why? He took my kids out to eat junk food. Affects my ambitions to have my kids eat only healthy things. What's my part? It's not my business. My husband's relationship with my kids, his kids too, unless he's doing something dangerous. And okay, we can argue whether taking them to McDonald's is dangerous. I might say yes, but I'm probably wrong. Dangerous means leaving them in the bathtub and walking away, right? Which is something obviously he never did. My husband's relationship with my kids is none of my business. I would get mad sometimes if my son was outside playing basketball, shooting hoops, and he'd say, Dad, come shoot hoops with me. And my husband would say, no. And I would get mad, like, you should be playing basketball with Daniel. And so what's my inventory? I resent my husband not playing with my kids the way I think he should. What's my part? It's none of my business. Another thing that is often our part is entitlement. And we couch this under expectations, like, well, I expected her to do blank. I expected him to be fill in the blank. Well, that's not really me admitting anything wrong about myself. That's just saying what I expected, right? Like, I wake up and I expect the sun to rise in the morning. That's no defect of mine. That's nothing bad in my part. But if I get angry because I have an unmet expectation, then I don't just have an expectation, I have an entitlement. So here's an example that I have. My mother passed away about a year and a half ago. She was in a coma the last 8 or 9 days of her life. And she was living near me, and my sister was in Florida, and my sister didn't fly up. She didn't fly up to be with her the last days of her life. She didn't fly up to help me, you know, sort through all my mom's things and take care of it. She just didn't. So if I were to do a resentment inventory, it would be, I resent my sister because she left me alone to deal with our dying mother. What does it affect? Really, my ambition to not want to be by myself doing this. What's my part? And my part is, I think I'm entitled to have other people act the way I want so that I'll feel better. I am not entitled to have anyone act any way whatsoever. Now, of course, I can put up a boundary, right? I can put up a boundary and say, I don't want to be involved in relationship with people who aren't healthy or safe for me. I can do that. But I am not entitled to really anything. Recently, I had a little health scare thinking that I might have this condition that was not very good. And as I was waiting for the test to come back, you know, I was thinking about it, that first I was like angry. It's like, well, it's not my fault. It's like a genetic thing. No matter what I do, there's nothing I can do about it. So it would really be a resentment against God that, you know, I have or I may have this condition that's not very good. What's my part? My part is thinking I'm entitled to a long life, to perfect health, to, you know, not having this condition. I am not entitled to that. And by the way, I don't have it. I'm fine, and I'm not angry at God, even if at some point I do have it. Is the deal with us a lot of times, right? Like, if something happens, if our kids get sick, if we get sick, if someone we love dies, it's like, God, where were you? God, you're bad. But God doesn't, you know, we don't wake up generally and think, man, how good God is. I woke up, I can see, I can hear, I'm not crippled, I have a job, I have air conditioning, I have food on the table. Oh my gosh, like, I get so much more than I'm entitled to. Yes, God is not fair. He gives me way more than I deserve. And that is true. God gives me so much more than I deserve. You know, another part where we're often wrong is playing God, right? I think this person should treat that person that way. I am playing God. You know, I think this, you know, in politics, this happens a lot. I'm playing God. And we just don't want to do that. And again, sometimes we're angry at God. But I think when we do, we should think about the way, and we think God is unfair. And I think we should go back and think away about the ways God is really unfair in our favor. Sometimes people ask, should I do a resentment inventory against myself? I find that very awkward if I say, let's say, I resent myself for not being very nice to my husband yesterday. Well, then I say, well, what's my part? Well, my part is, I was not very nice to my husband yesterday. What does it affect? It's just very awkward. So what I do in those situations is I just go, and in my nightly review is I say, you know, God forgive me, yesterday I was unkind. I treated it as a character defect that I confess, tell someone else about, ask God to remove, and make any amends if I need to. I find that's a lot cleaner than try to go through the gyrations of, you know, why I resent myself. So, okay, so it says, going back to page 67, when we saw our faults, we listed them. So after I see my part in column 5, I list my defects that have caused my part. You know, entitlement, playing God, being a peace faker, right? Dishonest, all of those things, I just list them. And then we go to the next part of our inventory, the fear inventory. So bottom of page 67, it talks about fear. It says, this short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. I find that very interesting. So often we talk about fear as an emotion, right? But emotions aren't ever described as evil, right? If I'm happy or, let's say, sad, no one ever says, oh, you're sad. Sad is an evil emotion, right? Because it's just an emotion, like I'm sad. But they're saying fear is evil. How come? And they go even further, and they say that fear sets in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling. Okay, so they're saying if I have fear, it's something evil, and it's not just, oh, it makes me feel bad. It sets in motion trains of circumstances which brings me misfortune. So let's compare fear to our step 2. Step 2 says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves, and they're talking about God, can restore us to sanity. Why is that step even there? Why does it matter what I believe as long as I do the work? Because faith is currency in the spiritual world and actually is a catalyst for things to happen, right? In the physical world, our currency is money, right? I go to the grocery store, I hand the clerk a $50 bill or a credit card, which represents money, and I get a bag of groceries. Well, I can't go to God and hand him my, you know, American Express card. The currency is in the spiritual world is faith. It is actually a catalyst that causes things to happen. And that's why we have to believe that God can restore us to sanity. Okay, so there, you know, so that's my step 2. And then what's fear? Fear is the opposite. Fear is trusting that God won't come through. So fear is basically trusting in the illness. And just like faith sets things in motion, fear sets things in motion, but not good things. And it says, we set the ball rolling by having the fear. So we definitely need to get rid of this fear. And it says, sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. And I think, okay, where is stealing? Like, where do we hear about stealing? And for me personally, I think of the Ten Commandments, right? Thou shalt not steal. And I think, okay, there's no commandment that says thou shalt not fear. But I think of the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. I need to trust in God more than I trust in fear. And they say, fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble than theft, than greed. I mean, these are things that can get us put in jail. And they're saying fear is worse. So here's how they tell us to get rid of them. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We listed them. Sometimes we'll see fears as a cause of our resentments. But we review them. Sometimes just plain old fear. We ask ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Now, I've seen fear inventories where it's, why do I have my fear? Is it because self-reliance failed me? Check yes or no. I don't think that's what they mean. They say we ask ourselves why we had them. So we drill down. So here's my best example. When my daughter was 16, I was afraid to discipline her. And by the way, that fear resulted in a lot of calamity. It resulted in me under-disciplining her and then getting so mad that I would over-discipline her and be too harsh. So it was this yo-yo of letting her get away with everything and then being too harsh. And, you know, thank God, God is good. I've made my amends. We're good. But it's left some scars that I have to live with. So here's a drill down. I'm afraid to discipline my daughter because then once she becomes 18, she'll want nothing to do with me. If she wants nothing to do with me, then on holidays, I'll be all alone. If I'm all alone, I'll be sad. Then I look for the dishonest thinking. What's the dishonest thinking? That disciplining children appropriately leads to them not wanting to talk to you again. That if I don't have my daughter, I'll be all alone and lonely. So I look at that. I look at all my, you know, what are my fears? Why I have them, and I drill them down to like I'll be sad or I'll be uncomfortable, and then I look at the dishonest thinking. So I do that for all my fears, and then here's what the book says. It says, okay, perhaps there's a better way than self-confidence. It says, yeah, we think so. We're on a different basis, a different basis. So I think of like the Wizard of Oz. We go from black and white to color. Right? We're now living in the world of the spirit, a different basis. The basis of trusting and relying on God. We trust infinite God who has infinite power, more than my finite self. And then here's a formula. I'm in the world to play the role that God assigns. So listen up. Just to the extent I do as I think God would have me and humbly rely on him, does he enable me to match calamity with serenity? So here's the formula. It's like A unit of doing what I think God would have me do, plus B unit of humbly relying on him equals AB unit of serenity. Doesn't matter how much calamity is going on, right? So if I have fear, I'm either not doing what I think God would have me, or I'm not trusting him with the outcome. And so it tells us what we do. It says, we let God demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask God, so again, we pray, we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. Now, again, people have called and asked me questions. What's the difference between asking God what he would have us be and asking him what he would have us do? I'm like, I don't know. I really don't know, but just in our last column, once we list our fears, we pray, and I tell people, and what I've done is pray one by one, God, please remove this fear. What would you have me be? What would you have me do? So, for instance, I had a sponsor, and she said she had a fear of her car breaking down at night and her getting, you know, killed, like mugged and killed. So what would God have her do? Always make sure her car is in good condition, not drive alone at night. You know, what would God have me do in that instance with my daughter? Discipline her appropriately and trust that everything will work out well. And by the way, my daughter is now 23 and we have a very good relationship. So we go through and we do our fears. And then it talks about doing a sex inventory where we review the past. So again, this is just a way. What I have my sponsees do is there's a sheet where they list who they hurt, what they did, how it hurt the person, and what they should have done instead, right? Because that teaches us for the future. And then there's a fifth column, what should the amends be? And we leave that aside until we get to step eight. So here it talks about we review our sex conduct. And we particularly look at, you know, did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? What should we have done instead? A lot of times in my own inventory, I saw my part, I should never have gotten involved or I should have left the relationship sooner. And then the last part is we create a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. You know, up on the top of the page, it says, we want to stay out of this controversy on how people should live their sex life. We aren't life coaches, right? So I have no right to tell someone how they should run their sex life, run their business, run their marriage, raise their kids. We stay out of the controversy. We don't want to be the comforter. We just direct people toward God so that we ask God, God, please give me a sane and sound ideal. It says, whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, except here's the caveat, provided we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. By the way, that's the only reason we don't make amends, if we would bring about more harm to others in doing it. And it says we treat sex as we would any other problem. So here's what it says we do. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. So already on step four, we see that we are praying and we are meditating. And by the way, when I sponsor someone, one of the requirements I give is to spend 30 minutes each morning in prayer, meditation, spiritual reading, because this program, because, right, we don't want it to be self-therapy, is about having a relationship with God so that the grace of God can come in and do a miracle in us, basically do a renovation job in our hearts, a spiritual experience, and remove the food obsession. So we pray and we meditate. We ask God what we should do. And it says the right answer will come if we want it. What a beautiful promise that God, the creator of the universe, will communicate with us. Now, I have a friend and she has regular conversations with God, just like I would talk to my husband, just like back and forth. For me, the answer generally comes, I'll get a line out of the big book or the Bible, or sometimes a line out of a song that guides me in the right direction. For some people, it's just like a feeling in their gut as to what the right thing is to do. But we are to be praying and meditating right from the beginning. In our book, it says, we vigorously commence this way of life as we cleaned up the past. Bottom of 69, they say, but God alone can judge our sex situation. And I would apply that to everything. God alone can, you know, judge my sex life, can judge my politics. Some things are just between us and God. And it says, counsel with others is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice in all areas. And then they say to us, okay, suppose we fall short of our ideal and stumble. Are we going to get drunk or binge? And they say, maybe, maybe. So that's how seriously they take following our sex ideal. They say, if we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, right? Realizing I can't do better on my own power. We believe we will be forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. I mean, that's pretty scary. They're telling me that if my conduct continuously harms other people, I'm quite sure to eat compulsively. So this tells me a couple things. It tells me, first of all, I don't have to live with shame, right? If I'm sorry for something I've done and I go to God and I ask to be forgiven, I'll be forgiven. I don't have to live with shame. If I continue to harm others, I'm going to eat compulsively. I think this is really important when we're sponsoring. So we've seen like two things in this chapter that lead to eating compulsively, harboring resentment and falling down on our sex ideal and harming others. There's other things in the big book, right? When it talks about amends, it says we must lose our fear of facing creditors, for we're liable to drink otherwise. I think if someone eats compulsively, the wrong thing for a sponsor to do is to automatically put that person back to step one. What if that person ate compulsively because there's an amend she's refusing to make? Or she's going down on her sex ideal, right? The absolute worst thing I could do is to say, okay, let's start over in the doctor's opinion. Let's start over in step one. What I'm supposed to do is to say, go make that amend. Stop going down on your sex ideal. Stop falling down on your sex ideal. Stop harming other people and, you know, fix that. Because otherwise, the person who's, you know, falling down on their sex ideal, not making their amends, they're going to, let's say the person isn't making their financial amends, they're going to happily, maybe subconsciously, but they're going to go 1 through 8, eat compulsively, find a new sponsor, do 1 through 8 over and over and never make that amend. So someone calls me and she says, you know, I need a new sponsor. And I say, okay, where'd you get in step? Well, I got up to step 9 and then I binged. Okay, was there an amend you didn't make? Yes. Okay, the first thing you need to do is go make that amend. So I think we have to be really careful of not doing the always revert to step 1 and having our sponsees avoiding things like dealing with a difficult resentment, making a difficult amend, causing harm to others, not living up to our sex ideal. So continuing back page 70, they say to sum up about sex, and it tells us what we pray for, the right ideal for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, and I said, like, when you cross out sex and fill in the blank with anything is very troublesome in our lives, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of other people's needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves, and I'm not thinking so much about what I'm not getting that I want. Okay, home stretch now. It says, so if we've been thorough about our inventory, we've written a lot. We've written about our resentments. We've begun to see they're futile and fatal. We've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all people, even our enemies, right? So we've started to change. We've started to grow in tolerance, patience, and goodwill. And they conclude by saying, in this book you read again and again, faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves, right? Remember, faith is the currency in the spiritual world. They say, we hope you're convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. Remember, it's not the food that has blocked us off from him. Food is a symptom that we are blocked off from him. It's our self-will, our defects, our resentments, our fears, our harms that we haven't fixed, that have blocked us off from him. But we have to be convinced that God can remove them. Remember, faith is currency in the spiritual world. And they end by saying, if this is true, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Not fun, right? Not fun to see that I'm not the wonderful person that I thought I was, but so helpful. And what's on the other side, right? A spiritual experience, God coming in and rearranging our hearts and lives and kicking out the food obsession. And with that, I will pass.
Beautiful, Janet B. Thank you so much for this thorough and instructive presentation on the subject of step 4, chock full of your personal examples, experiences, insights, making for another gem for the archives. Thank you. Share ID for today's presentation, 21,570. That's 21570. Janet's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so you'll need to stay tuned for that. And we will transition right now to a question and answer segment. You can pose a question, questions only, to Janet by pressing *1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Tony B.
Tony B. Somebody C. Who is that?
Susan C.
Good morning, Susan. Thank you. *1 to unmute. All right, let's just jump in right now with Tony B, please. Your question.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Leah. And thank you, Janet. That was really a wonderful presentation. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about, you said, I think, look at how things are unfair in my favour. I was interested in that and wondered if you'd talk a bit more about that.
Sure. So so many times we get angry at God or say we don't want to believe in God because we think God isn't fair because, you know, this person in our life died or that person got sick or, you know, I didn't get the promotion I wanted or something, that God isn't fair. And we're really being unfair to God because we never stop and think, yeah, God is unfair. He has given me so much more than I deserve. I have, you know, I can walk, I can talk, I have a job, I have air conditioning. You know, I have all these things. I live in a country where I'm free. It's not fair that I get that and, you know, 2/3 of the world are living in poverty. God is unfair in my favor by blessing me with so much more than I deserve. Thanks.
Thank you, Tony B. Susan C., your turn.
Yeah, thanks. Good morning. And thank you both. Really great presentation. And something you brought up, Janet, was interesting to me, got me thinking, I mean, a lot of things, but one in particular. I think about the 9th step amends I made before I became abstinent and then in the many years that I have been abstinent. And the ability to take responsibility was different. The sloppiness was level was different. And so I really get what you're saying about not wanting to avoid and just go back to step one and keep using it as a you know, diversionary tactic. But I'm also interested, you know, if someone has picked up and is under the influence, so to speak, you know, what their capacity to make an amends in that state might look like. I just wonder if you had any further things to say on that. Thanks so much.
I was talking about someone who was going through the steps and was abstinent and was working the steps and then got to a point where they just didn't make the amend and then they picked up. So honestly, I think if someone just picks up, but they've done a good eighth step, they can go out and make an amend. They can go back and make that amend because that's what the block is. Now, if someone made amends before they started working the steps, I think what I generally do is I say, okay, let's go over when they get to the A step, let's go over that amend you made before and let's talk about it and see if you need to do more. So for instance, if someone took $10 from Susie's wallet and they paid it back and said, I'm sorry. Well, even if they were, you know, under the influence, as you say, well, they did it, they still did it and they've made the amend. So there would be no need to go back. But if there's stuff, and usually it's stuff with our families, sometimes we have to go back and redo them. So, thanks.
Thank you, Susan. Great opportunity to pose questions to our speaker, Janet B. You can do so by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Geraldine H.
Is that Geraldine? Did I get that correct? The last name, I just wanted the last person. Could you please clarify for me?
Geraldine H.
Okay, thank you, Geraldine. Appreciate that help. Who else would like to ask a question this morning?
Kim B.
Kim B.
Michelle M. from.
Thank you, Michelle.
Bev M.
Bev M. Okay, I have Geraldine H., Kim B., Michelle M., and Bev M. We'll go ahead and get started with Geraldine M. H.
Mary M.
Thank you. Thank you, Leah, and thank you, Janet. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, lovely. Janet, that was just amazing, and just I found that so clarifying and so helpful. It was absolutely, for me, what the big book tells us to do. My question is, I have been in and out of program for a long time and I cannot maintain abstinence. And I, at the moment, I'm trying to get abstinent again, but the cravings are so powerful. I can't, of myself, I can't get through them. I can't figure out what I need to do to get through them. And I know that the steps are the answer, but I don't know whether, I don't know how to get to a place where the steps are working and I'm actually able to get through to being abstinent and working the steps. So some people say you can't work the steps until you're abstinent. Some people say you've got to keep working the steps and then you'll get abstinent. So that's my question really, is how do you get through the craving when you just, it's just too powerful. Thanks.
Okay, so that's a good question, a hard question. So here's what I would say. Obviously, you can't work the steps as you're sitting there, you know, shoving things down your throat. However, if you're not shoving things down your throat right now, you can start right now. So there's a couple things I would suggest to you. First, I would ask you to look if there's any dishonesty in your life, because this program requires rigorous honesty. God will not coexist with dishonesty. So if there's any dishonesty in your life, to clean it up right away. To start connecting with God right away. And you can start with a prayer. If you don't believe in God, you can say, God, I don't know if you exist. And if you exist, I don't know if you care about me. But if you do exist and you do care, please help me. Okay? And the worst that happens is there's no God and nothing happens. But I believe that that prayer can cause God to spring into action and like say to his angels, okay, our next search and rescue mission is for her. But once you say that prayer, you can't just stop there. You have to do everything in your power that you believe God would want you to do if he existed. So we know God wouldn't want us to lie. God wants us to love on his other children, which means self-sacrifice for the good of other people. God wants us to connect with him. So start spending time in prayer, meditation, spiritual reading. I would say that this is almost impossible to do without a network of people. So I would get yourself a sponsor who has been through these 12 steps and can help you put your hands in the hand of God. I always give my sponsees about 20 phone numbers of people in recovery who they can call. And I tell them they have to make 3 calls, not hi, how's the weather calls or voicemail calls, but real conversations about the big book, steps, their life, God, their struggles, and start working the steps. You can this minute start recovering and not binge again. When I started recovery, it was right after a meeting. I had been binging behind a locked bathroom door right before the meeting. And after that meeting, I went out and I just said to God, everything I thought, you know, about you, I'm willing to admit it's all wrong and start over. And I got a sponsor who was tough as nails, but who I knew could help me. And I did everything I was told. So I would just advise you to do the same, and your recovery could start this minute, forever. Permanent recovery forever. Thanks.
Thank you, Geraldine H. Kim B., your turn.
Yeah, this is Kim B. in Wisconsin. I just, great presentation. I needed this today. My question is, A little further, if you could expand a little, I'm struggling with setting healthy boundaries, especially in my work environment, and just how steps 6 and 7 come into play with that as well, you know, kind of trusting God in that reliance to act as if our defects of character, especially fear, I think that is what prevents me from finding my voice to speaking up. So if you could talk a little bit more about how you bring God into having those difficult conversations and setting up those boundaries, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, so it's a little hard to do that without knowing, getting in the weeds and knowing the specifics of the situation. I mean, for instance, I told my boss, like, I won't look at emails on Sunday. And I said, if you have a true emergency thing, call me. But I won't look at work emails. But I know my boss, and I knew he would respect it. Now, if I was in a prior job, you know, they might have said, no, you need to be on call 24/7. If you're not willing to do that, you lose your job. So I'm hesitant to give advice on how to set boundaries without knowing the particulars of your job situation. So what I would say is you should probably talk to your sponsor about the specifics. And then if you believe you should set boundaries, just again, work with your sponsor on what that would look like. And as far as bringing God into it, I think it's prayer and meditation. God, what do healthy boundaries look like in this situation? Please remove my fear. But again, before we ask God to remove our fear, we really have to analyze it and see why we have it. So I hope that helps.
Thank you, Kim B. Next up, Michelle M., your question, please.
Hi, Janet. Thank you so much for your time today. This was so helpful. So my question is, you mentioned there's two things that could lead to, like two big things that could lead to compulsive overeating, one being fear and the other one was falling down on our sex ideals. Could you give an example of what it looks like to fall? Can you hear me? To fall down on your sex ideals and just give a little clarity about, like, behind that.
Yeah, I think what they're talking, I mean, I think probably what they had in mind is if someone's sex ideal is to be faithful to their spouse and they're not faithful to their spouse, they shouldn't expect, and they just keep cheating on their spouse, they shouldn't expect to be okay and to be able to be sober. Okay.
Thank you, Michelle M. Bev M., your turn.
Good morning. Thanks for your beautiful going through the big book for the 4-step. I have a question. So I've gone through the 12 steps quickly, and I am now in 10, 11, 12. And I am finding character defects and, like, habits of living that I didn't realize when I first went through my 4-step. And I'm just wondering what would be the circumstances that you would think it would be a good idea to go back and redo the 4-step?
So I think in that situation, what I would generally advise people step, where you just go through your defects, you go through your resentments, and you go through your fears, and you sit and you go over them with somebody. So, I mean, I don't think it matters if you call it a 4-step. I call it an Uber 10-step. That's why we generally want to be cleaning stuff up every day. But it does happen that sometimes there's just certain situations that are so big that we need to do like an Uber 10-step. So I would recommend if that's what you feel you need to do, you get with your sponsor and you just do it.
Thanks, Bev M. Mary M., your turn.
Hi, this is Mary M. My question is this. I have been abstinent for several years, and I have a sponsor, and she has a good faith and a higher power, and I don't. And I have tried for years to develop a trust and a faith and a higher power, and it just doesn't come. I just don't have it. And right now I'm going through a difficult time with my daughter, and I'm worried for her, and I try to pray for her, but I don't really believe it. I mean, I do it anyway. I act as if anyway, but I don't really have that faith and trust that I wish I did. So I'm wondering if you have any advice on that. Thank you.
Yeah, so first, honestly, I would say if you don't have a belief, it's very hard to go through the steps, because step three, right, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. If a person doesn't believe in God, how can she turn her will and her life over to something she doesn't believe in? It doesn't make sense. So I would say you've got a lot of step two work to do. A lot of work, because right, step two says came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And in the chapter We Agnostics, it says about half the founders of AA didn't believe. So I would say, as long as you're willing to believe that maybe there's a God, you can work on there. But I would say you really have a lot of step two work to do. And I would encourage you to really spend some time working on step two in the chapter We Agnostics, and just doing work on that, because you can't proceed without that. That's my thoughts on it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary M., for your question. We still have time for one, perhaps two questions. Anyone? Rosalyn. Anyone else? Otherwise, we'll assume all minds are clear. Okay.
Elena Rosalyn? From New York City. I'd like to ask questions.
Okay, you got in the nick of time. Rosalyn and then Elaine. Go ahead, Rosalyn.
Thanks, Leah. Thanks, Janet, for your message here. It was really good. And I wanted to kind of hone in on the dishonest part, because it keeps leading me back to the food. So it's an area with my mother, and you mentioned being, you know, the sacrifice, and then I'm hearing boundaries. I have a very difficult issue with distinguishing how much of me to give and where does the boundary set. So if you can kind of elaborate more on that, like laying my life down, but then it turns where I go back into the food because I can't handle it. So can you speak on that self, the sacrifice part, and then setting the boundaries?
Okay, so I heard you ask a lot of things about dishonesty, self-sacrifice, and boundaries. So again, our big book is really clear. It says, he knows he must be honest if he would live at all. So we have to be honest. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how much step work we do, how many meetings we go to, we're not going to get better. The difference between boundaries and how to know how to set appropriate boundaries and self-sacrifice, and what's self-sacrifice, honestly, that's something, and I do talk to my sponsees about it, and there's actually stuff I recommend, a book they recommend they read on boundaries. So I think that's something best discussed with a sponsor in an individual situation, because what could be self-sacrifice for one person could be like a boundary violation for, you know, for another person. I think generally if I do something out of love, then that's good, and that's a self-sacrifice. But I don't want to give a blanket pronouncement and say it always has to be that, because sometimes, honestly, if I'm like helping someone, I'm just doing it because I feel it's the right thing to do, not because, oh, I love doing it at this moment, when I would rather be like lying by the pool reading a book. Yay, I'm so glad someone called me with a problem. But I do it anyway, and I believe that's okay with God. So I'm sorry I can't answer more specifically, but I think that's something someone has to get in the weeds with you on to answer.
Thanks, Rosalyn. Our final question for this morning comes from Elaine F.
Hi, this is Elena from New York City. Just bear with me because my son is 8 years old hanging around here. I heard you say that a lot of times we're picking up because of amends we didn't do from the past. I just find that for me, it seems like it's because I'm not acting right in the moment. And I sort of connect it like I'm rude to my husband. I'm impatient. I'm very impatient a lot of times. It's really, and I guess that's a 10th step. I don't want to answer my own question. The other thing I want to say is I never did a lot of my amends for many years. I'm in that cycle also, and I keep, you know, having a really hard time doing like the ex-boyfriend and the work amends. And I just keep trying. It's actually for like a decade or more. So I'm just struggling with that. I can't seem to get past it. Those are my two questions.
So I think there's multiple causes of things that lead us into relapse. I did a podcast on vision once. It's called Pitfalls in Recovery. There's about, I don't know, 15 different things the big book lists that can cause us to go into relapse. So yes, not making amends is one of them. And another one can be continuing to harm other people. So both of those things can cause relapse. And as far as not making amends from the past, the best advice I can give is to work with a competent sponsor to get through the steps so you can get to step 8, which is became willing to make amends to them all. It looks like you have a problem with step 8B, right? The first part is make the list. That's easy. The second part is became willing to make amends to them all. And the big book gives advice as to what to do if we're not willing to make amends. So you might want to pull it out and, you know, peruse that again. Thanks.
What does it say if we're not willing to make amends? I don't know. Where is that?
Chapter 6.
Okay.
Thank you, Elaine F. Thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And, of course, thank you, Janet, for spending all this time with us this morning, sharing your personal experience, insights, and how you implemented the steps to now have a life which is happy, joyous, and free. Thank you so much for your service. Again, today's share ID, 21,570. That's 21570 for this morning's presentation. We will now close from page 164. It's in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.